Odyssey is giving you a chance to win a trip to London to see Taylor Swift at the Eras Tour. It's Tay in the UK.
Hey, it's Taylor.
Just download the free Odyssey app, log in and listen to a participating station for a minimum of 60 minutes to get your daily entry. And you could win a chance to fly off to London with three friends and see Taylor.
I can't wait to see you at the Eras Tour in London.
For more, go to odyssey.com/Taylor. Tay in the UK.
It's on the Odyssey app.
Thanks to Republic Records.
This is a national contest.
I'm sure you've dealt with thousands, maybe even millions, of very enthusiastic Star Trek fans.
We have indeed.
Yes. I'm sure some screaming, crying, shaking. What is, if you could give a little guidance to some folks who maybe may meet you at the show or see you, what is the way not to approach George Takei when you see him?
Well, you know, the way I love to have people approach me is as who they are. And sometimes they're tremulous with excitement. They're usually young girls, you know, just trembling and not so nervous. But then there are others that try to be your old buddy from television. You know, they know Sulu well, and they keep calling me Sulu.
Oh, yeah.
But if that's how they see me, I will accept them and eventually try to get them to know me as who I am, George Takei. So, no, I don't have any guidance for how to approach me.
As long as they're not screaming bloody murder or something like that, I think.
Oh, no, I wouldn't murder them.
Okay. Is there a very memorable moment when you with a Star Trek fan that you can remember, something that may have been completely awkward?
Well, I get requests for autographs, and some of them are on their bodies, you know, on their arms or on their necks.
Yes.
But there have been requests for my autograph to be on some rather private parts of the anatomy.
Possibly a photon torpedo or two. Yes, that could get awkward, very much so.
It does indeed.
You are coming to Boston on Friday. You're going to be at the Box Center Wang Theater, and they're going to be showing Star Trek Wrath of Khan, and you will be hosting, but you'll be doing a little more than that. You're going to be doing a Q&A.
Exactly.
Telling some stories.
I'll be talking certainly about the amazing 50-year journey that we've had, and some of the wonderful things that have happened, and some of the challenging things that have happened, and also to, you know, primarily to thank them for the support that they've given me over a half a century, and now, and some of them haven't been around for that long. Most of them are actually from the rerun generation.
Yes, that would be me.
Subsequent movie generation. So it spans an amazing generational span of love for Star Trek.
I was reading Mark Altman's 50-year mission book, which I really enjoyed, and William Shatner and DeForest Kelly and James Doohan all kind of described making The Wrath of Khan the most fun. It was fun making that movie. Do you agree with that?
It was fun, but I wouldn't call it the most fun. Jimmy called it that. I thought it would have been Star Trek IV, where we went on location to San Francisco.
Oh, yes, with the whale. Yes, the whales. And,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people call Wrath of Khan the best Star Trek movie,
well,
as far as the original series.
The fans have been the best judge of that, and very intriguingly, they've selected all the even-numbered ones.
Hmm.
Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, and Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. All the even numbers, 2, 4, 6.
Huh.
And I must agree with them, because some of the odd-numbered ones were odd.
Well, so let's for a second talk about Star Trek IV. You said you had the most fun making that one. What made that the most fun?
Well, to be on location in San Francisco And that's where we reveal that that was where Sulu was born. And just incidentally, that was my father's hometown. And I love San Francisco. I'm an Angeleno. I was born here in Los Angeles. But my parents were Northern Californians. My mother was born in Sacramento. But they met and married here in Southern California. And despite the famous north-south tension in California, I embrace the whole state. I'm a second-generation Californian, and I love the uniqueness of all of the various areas of California. San Francisco is a singular, dazzling, urbane place. Sacramento, of course, is our national or state capital, and it's a charming mid-size city. My grandparents, my maternal grandparents, were in farming in that area, and I still have a lot of relatives in that area, although my father's side of the family all came down to Los Angeles. So I have no family there, but I have a lot of friends in San Francisco. And, of course, Southern California is a paradisical place. So I'm a Californian. I embrace the entire state, north and south, east and west.
So if I could divert for a little bit, there's this, I keep seeing this stuff on Facebook and Twitter about people wanting California to secede from the Union.
People is that?
Well, it's various sources. You know, I saw something, I think it was on Huffington Post. They said that there's a petition going around or something. Where, you know, how do you feel about that?
Well, that's always been, you know, just like there's a North-South tension, there have been people, and particularly now with the new Donald Trump administration, there's a strong a feeling that we are not represented by that president. And so there's that. But that there's always been that feeling because we are, I think, the fifth largest economy in the world.
Yes.
And we're not independent. We are a part of the fabric of the United States, but we are the strongest and most populous state in the United States. We are the most diverse, both geographically, in the population, and in geography of our state. So we are unique, and we do produce some unique people. We are an actively engaged populace, and we embrace the whole spectrum from the arch conservative to the wild extreme liberal. And so, you know, there's that whole spectrum of political feelings. But I'm someone who believes in a seamless global society. Yes, California is unique. But part of that uniqueness comes from the fact that we are part of the United States, which is a unique nation, a singular nation. But we're that singular nation because we're part of this global society.
Right.
So I consider myself a person who's a citizen of the world.
Much like the Federation,
all
species, all kinds, all welcome.
Yes.
Absolutely.
We're going to be a global civilization.
So getting back to Wrath of Khan, so you almost didn't do that movie, right?
I was eagerly looking forward to that. I think some of the fan chit-chat says that was the one that I was reluctant to come back to. It was actually Star Trek V.
Oh.
And this is all, you know, we'll be going into this, I'm sure, in the Q&A there in Boston. But it was Star Trek V because I had been lobbying for a captaincy for Sulu because, you know, Starfleet is supposed to be a meritocracy. And over the years, from our television years to the movie years, we kept getting title changes. You know, I was a lieutenant at the beginning, and then I became a lieutenant commander,
right,
and then a commander. But I was always chained to that damn helm console, saying the
right.
same thing. Aye, sir, warp 3, you know.
Yeah.
And I said, if this is supposed to be a meritocracy, it's got to actually have a advance in the person's career. And Sulu was supposed to be number one out of Starfleet Academy. He also was reputed to be the best helmsman of Starfleet. And if so, there should be a show of, you know, advance in his career and advance in his duties. And certainly he should at least be a first officer. And so, you know, I would buttonhole Gene Roddenberry or anybody on the writing team or even the directors, which change regularly on the television series, and as a matter of fact, with the movies as well, although we had Nick Meyer, the most consistent movie director
yes.
and writer. So I lobbied everybody. And in Star Trek 2 or 3, was it? I can't remember now. There was a scene that was written in for me, a very brief scene where Kirk announces to me privately that I got an advance. But that scene didn't work out.
Oh.
It landed on the cutting room floor. And so, you know, I kept up the lobbying, but when it came time for Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, you know, Leonard had directed two of the Star Trek movies.
Yes.
Star Trek III and IV. And IV was enormously successful, both in terms of the reviews, the box office, and certainly the fans' enthusiasm. And Bill Shatner is a very competitive guy, and Leonard had directed two in a row, and he was getting all this hosannas about directing Star Trek IV. And so Bill insisted that he's got to be the director for Star Trek V. And I was not that keen on joining in on that. And so I had passed on it. But then Harv Bennett tried to court me, and I love Harv. He was a wonderful producer and a writer, as well as a general shepherd for the franchise. And so, you know, I told Harv, yeah, I love Star Trek, and I'm grateful for the enhancement of my career, but I'm getting a little tired of it, and I don't know whether it could work with me working with Bill Shatner. And so he accepted that. But then I got a call from Nichelle Nichols in her very seductive voice, luring me back to the show. As it turned out, she was calling me from Bill's living room. They were having a dry read of the script in his living room. And Bill had asked Nichelle to call me because he knew that we were friends. And I said, well, Nichelle, you know, we'll talk it over privately at lunch. I know that you're in an uncomfortable situation there. And then Bill came on, and I said, you know, I just can't do it. I'm going to have to pass. But Harv called back again, and he said, you know, we have an ensemble, and that's so important for the success of Star Trek. And so I finally signed on.
Now
but it wasn't Star Trek 2. You know, we were still fresh from doing the Star Trek movies, and I was very excited about doing Star Trek 2, The Wrath of Khan, particularly because Ricardo was going to be coming back.
Yes.
Ricardo Montalban.
Yes, and I wanted to ask you, how was it working with him? He's such
Ricardo?
The presence there is just so amazing.
We had no scenes with him, but Ricardo dropped in on the set periodically. As a matter of fact, he had some photo sessions during the times that we were shooting our Enterprise scenes, and Ricardo would stop by. And you know, he really is a legendary figure in film history because
yes.
he started out as a contract player at MGM Studios, which was the leading studio, the most glamorous, most glittering, most successful studio in Hollywood in the 40s and 50s and 60s. And he was a contract actor there, and working with all of the legendary stars that MGM had. And then, of course, by the time of the Star Trek movies, the contract system went out. But Ricardo was groomed in that star system, and he was a bigger-than-life character and very theatrical. And so it was always kind of fun to sit and chit-chat with him because of the grandness, the bigness. Even, you know, this is he was visiting the set, but he dressed for it. He had a cravat.
And oh, yeah.
He was dressed to the teeth. And it was, for me, a kind of an opportunity to go back to the glamour days of Hollywood.
Yeah, he's, I mean, you know, I love Benedict Cumberbatch, and when he came back in the darkness, I was like, he's good, but that's not Khan. That's not no. Ricardo Montalban.
You know? I'm a Benedict Cumberbatch fan, too, but, you know, there's, well, J.J. Abrams, who got the franchise with the last three films,
yeah.
He really doesn't understand Star Trek. He'd never met Gene Roddenberry, and he didn't know about Gene Roddenberry's idea of using science fiction as a metaphor for a commentary on current-day issues. And certainly the very ship itself, the Starship Enterprise, was a metaphor for Starship Earth. And he reminded us constantly that the diversity of this planet, this starship, was the strength of this starship. And that's why you saw the makeup of the cast and certainly the leadership crew on the bridge. We were from all parts of this planet. And Spock, who was from another planet as well.
Right.
And that diversity is what gave strength to this starship. And J.J. didn't understand that. And he really didn't understand how my character came to have the name Sulu. Because his office called one morning when they were preparing the first of J.J.'s movies. And they asked me to have breakfast with J.J., and I thought, oh, how interesting, because I'd recently heard that Leonard Nimoy was invited back to do a cameo on that Star Trek film, and I thought maybe there might be a cameo brewing for me, too.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I eagerly went to that breakfast, and I found J.J. to be a very interesting guy, fascinating, a lot of ideas, you know, and quick-talking, very energetic guy. But the reason he wanted to have breakfast with me was he told me he was trying to find a Japanese-American actor, because I'm Japanese-American,
yes,
to play Sulu.
Huh.
But he found an actor that he's very interested in casting as Sulu, that's not Japanese-American. And he asked me what I thought of that. And I asked him, well, is who you're looking at Asian-American? And he said, yes. And I told him, that's all that matters. Because Gene Roddenberry wanted us to represent different parts of this starship Earth, this planet. And I was to represent Asia, not Japan.
Right.
And Asia is made up of many, many different countries. And as long as the actor that you're looking at is Asian, that's all that matters. And I asked him, do you know how Sulu the name Sulu came to be attached to the Asian character? He said, no. And I told him I showed him how deeply Gene Roddenberry thought about the characters that he was creating. This character was supposed to represent Asia, But Asia in the 20th century was turbulent with warfare and colonization. As you know, Japan colonized Korea,
mm-hmm.
and Korea was a colony of Japan for about 30, 40 years. And then Japan, during the Second World War, invaded China
yeah.
and Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't want to suggest all that. He wanted a name that suggested all of Asia rather than the tension and turbulence and the colonization and rebellions that was Asia was rife with. And to find that apt name, because, you know, Tanaka is a Japanese name, Wong is a Chinese name,
mm-hmm.
Kim is a Korean name, and he didn't want to suggest national, specifically national identity. And he had a map of Asia pinned on his wall, and he was staring at it, and he found off the coast of the Philippines the Sulu Sea, and he thought, ah, the waters of a sea touch all shores, and that's how he came up with the name Sulu. And so, you know, J.J. was very impressed by the depth of Gene's thinking. But, you know, looking at all three of the J.J. Abrams Star Treks, you know, you don't find that metaphorical use of science fiction in terms of issues of our times. And certainly in our times today, we have a lot of issues that could be translated into science fiction stories.
Oh, yeah.
Certainly just the past week,
you know,
we've been turbulent with the demonstrations and opposition and resistance. So I think the past three films have not been true Gene Roddenberry Star Trek films.
Now, with that being said, if J.J. Abrams came to you and said, hey, we'd love you to be in the next one, would you do that?
Of course. I'd love Star Trek.
Yeah.
I love the Star Trek fans, and I hope I'll have that opportunity to try to make that contribution to J.J. in adding that the philosophic dimension that Gene Roddenberry had.
Well, George Takei, it's been a pleasure, and you can see George. He will be at the Box Center Wang Theater this Friday here in Boston, hosting, answering questions, telling stories, and showing Star Trek Wrath of Khan. And one more final question about Wrath of Khan before we go. Who had a better wig in Wrath of Khan? Ricardo Montalban or William Shatner?
Well, at that time, a very believable one was on Bill.
Oh!
But a spectacular one was on Ricardo.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, that's great. George Takei, thank you so much. As a huge fan, I appreciate your time today. And really, best of luck to you. And also, thank you for doing what you do mostly now, and that's speaking up. And
well, that's very important.
Yes, I really appreciate it. Yeah. So thank you very much for doing that.
Well, great chatting with you. May you live long and prosper.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.